Welcome to Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff. I'm your host, Margaret Killjoy, and each week I take you way back into history to find people who were cool, who did stuff that was cool, because they were cool, so they did cool stuff. This is part two of a two-part series about Haymarket, the bomb that brings us the modern labor movement. So if you haven't already, you might want to do yourself a favor and go back and listen to part one. But I'm not the boss of you. Do whatever you want. And my guest this week is none other than Robert Evans. Robert,
hey.
What's the best way to describe you here?
I am the boss of you, and if you listen to this one before listening to the first one, I will wreak a terrible vengeance upon your soul.
Ew.
And that's who I am. That's all I am, is a force, okay. A force for revenge of Ew. Content. It's unclear what I am, Margaret, but I'm here to talk with you about this story.
And other people who were forces for revenge in their own right.
That's right. That's right. And the fact that revenge can sometimes lead to people being harmed that you didn't intend to harm, because once the consequences of actions can be unpredictable.
Exactly. Yeah. And we also have our producer, Sophie, here. Sophie, do you want to say hi?
Yeah, Robert. Ew.
Sophie.
Robert.
Sophie.
Margaret.
Hi.
Hi.
Sophie.
Okay. So we're going to get back to it. Where we last left our heroes, 200 folks were at an anarchist rally in Chicago. Cops had shown up. Someone had thrown a bomb. And I was pretty proud of that cliffhanger.
Yeah. Great first week cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thanks,
also,
thanks.
Solid Sylvester Stallone film. Cliffhanger.
Oh.
Good movie. Not enough mountain climbing thrillers these days.
Were there bombs in it?
I think there might have been, actually. There's definitely like terrorists and stuff. My memories of it are fuzzy. I haven't seen it since I was like 12 or so, but probably. Okay. I think probably.
So much like the bomb in the movie Cliffhanger, which I have definitely seen, this
presumably,
bomb.
Presumably, yes.
Yeah. This bomb shattered windows for blocks around, and one cop was killed immediately on the spot. The explosion was so loud that the mayor heard it from his bed. He had like ridden home on his horse, and then he got undressed and went to bed, and then he heard the explosion, and then he went to the window and he heard gunshots, so he mm-hmm. ran back out. The cops drew revolvers and they started firing wildly. Six more cops were killed. All of them were killed by other cops.
Oh, awesome. Critical support.
And so, because some of the anarchists were armed, right? The anarchists at the time were often armed. And some of them might have even shot back. But like all the forensic evidence of all of the bodies and all of the scene is like really strongly on the side that probably all of the cops were killed by all the other cops who were overreacting. And like one light post was entirely full of bullet holes that were all coming from the direction of the cops. So they like removed it and tried to destroy the evidence immediately.
That's just all such cop shit.
I know. This is like it's not the origin of cop shit. The origin of cop shit, well, actually, you covered very well. But it ties into
some of the origin. This is pretty early on in the concept of cop shit being a thing.
Yeah.
These guys were really breaking new ground in terms of shooting each other to death.
Uh-huh.
There's a mutual friend of ours, I think, Molly Conger, goes through like the websites that are like end of watch for cops. And mm-hmm. like, boy, howdy, a lot of cops die because other cops shoot them when they're doing like training in rooms and they're not like practicing proper gun safety and they shoot each other to death. It's like not an uncommon way for a cop to go out.
Yeah. Oh, God. And that's how six of them went out, or eventually, I think seven. One of them died like 2 years later from the wounds.
Well,
one of them, so it gets called a riot, but it wasn't a riot. It was either a short and bloody massacre, or at best, it was a short and bloody, pretty much one-sided battle.
There was no rioting at any point, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all over within like 5 minutes. And there was no records of civilian casualties because basically everyone who was shot there was like, I'm not saying shit. And they like dragged their friends' bodies away. And like some of them went to the hospital, but most of them just went off to go find somewhere else because they all knew what would happen if they showed up and said, I was at this thing. Okay. So Samuel Fielden, the speaker who was already having a rough night, you know, he's like going last, he's following a blowhard.
Yeah, boy, this is, it's as a public speaker, this is definitely a rough gig.
I know.
Tough crowd.
I know. Although, I'll go ahead and spoil that he actually has the best result of any of these people, of
That's
any
good.
Of the people who get arrested. But he gets shot in the knee, right away.
Oh, that's bad.
And then, as far as I can tell, a detective like snuck up and tried to assassinate the earlier speaker, August Spies. And then August Spies was saved by his brother, Henry, who like got in the way or whatever and got shot in the groin for his trouble of saving his brother's life.
Boy.
And yeah. So one of the things that's kind of wild about it is that if they had waited a few more minutes, the meeting was basically over. It was raining. Fielding was basically done. They were going to go home.
The worst speaker up there. Like, people are done.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of weird to try and think about. It doesn't do you any good, but to try and think about how differently the history of Chicago and the U.S. would have been if the cops had waited like a few minutes. But the thing is they probably weren't going to. Some folks back then and now think that the cops were going to attack the crowd. Whether or not they were going to like roll in with truncheons or whether or not they were going to just like open fire is kind of anyone's guess. But the guy who was in charge, Captain Bonfield, he had been itching to stamp out the anarchists like once and for all since earlier that day when he had like a council of war. And he waited until the mayor was gone and the crowd was at its weakest and then attacked. His nickname was Blackjack because he liked beating people so much with his Blackjack, his billy club, that it became his name.
Fun for him.
Yeah, he had such a reputation of beating people that at one point some like owners of a gasworks were like, hey, could you stop beating up our employees even when they're on strike? We actually need them. We need them to be able to work.
Too many of their bones.
Yeah. So it might have wound up a massacre either way, whether or not the bomb was thrown, but it's hard to say. And then one witness who was pro-cop said that Bonfield, during the wild, every cop shooting every which direction, grabbed a second gun off of a fallen cop and just started dual wielding into the crowd.
Oh, that's...
So this guy is probably killed more cops than any of the Chicago anarchists.
I'll bet he dropped a couple of them. Yeah. Guns don't work great when you use them that way.
Yeah. Okay, and so none of the anarchists who stood trial had thrown the bomb, but it's not like they were shy in the advocacy of dynamite.
Yeah.
In the years building up to Haymarket, one anarchist professor from New York wrote into one of the Chicago anarchist papers saying that he carried a bomb around in his pocket all of the time to dissuade cops from approaching.
Just always be a potential suicide bomber. That's how you avoid arrest.
Yeah. Which seems like it would work, but eventually backfire, you know?
It seems like it would work briefly.
Yeah. His quote was, "You can learn to make trinitroglycerine, and if you carry 2 or 3 pounds of it with you, people will respect you much more than if you carry a pistol."
My God.
In another letter, another person advocating for the use of dynamite wrote, "Dynamite, of all the good stuff, this is the stuff. A pound of this good stuff beats a bushel of ballots all hollow."
Wow.
Yeah. And so I bring this up because it's like there's a lot of things that I love about the Chicago anarchists, but I think they were kind of just wrong about dynamite.
That's probably a little bit. Look, will dynamite stop you from getting mugged? Perhaps.
Yeah.
Will it stop people from fucking with you? Perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah. Is the best way to stop people from getting fucked with you carrying a tool that indiscriminately would destroy large chunks of a neighborhood if detonated? Perhaps not.
Right, exactly. You just need to work on threat modeling a little better. I feel like that's what they weren't as good at.
I would say like it would be a little bit like, I mean, I do intend to one day chop a 20 millimeter anti-tank gun down to something that's legally a pistol and conceal carry it in case I get robbed
by a
Bradley fighting vehicle on my way home from the grocery store. But yeah. I don't pretend that's good, like a good idea.
Right. And I think at some level, some of these people knew that they were like participating in radical rhetoric because they liked radical rhetoric.
Yeah, because it's fun. Because it sounds cool as shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's definitely a character you want to put in a novel or, like, a movie. Like, the guy who's just like, yeah, I mean, you introduce him. He's, like, walking home in the early morning and this, like, cop sees him and, like, notices that he's some sort of, like, weirdo radical. Or even ideally, someone else is getting, like, fucked with by the police or by, like, some militia chuds or something. And he, like, walks in and they're like, well, what are you going to do about it? And then he opens his jacket and he's just strapped with dynamite. Like, absolutely. You can totally, like, definitely an intriguing character. But
exactly.
Objectively, maybe not the best idea.
And so... dynamite had actually been used in labor struggle before this, but no previous time had it targeted people at all. A couple times it was used to destroy property, including once in the Washington Territory, where someone dynamited the empty house of a guy who was foreclosing people out of mortgaged homes and evicting tenants from their rental homes.
Oh, you know, I was just talking with, for It Could Happen Here, with Jake Hanrahan about the riots in Cyprus he was at. And they're doing a version of this where they're destroying, like, using incendiaries to destroy people's vacation homes because it's, like, making the cost of living untenable. They're, like, bombing vacation homes.
You know, all right.
Yeah, yeah, I have no issue with that. You'll notice I'm not condemning that tactic.
Yeah. But this is the first time that a bomb is thrown in a labor struggle that I'm aware of, at least in the United States. And it so this causes America's very first Red Scare, which we have a long and proud tradition of. And all across the country, everyone freaks out. And it's like these damn anarchists and their dynamite and something must be done, don't you know? And conspiracies go wild. The anarchists are going to level the city. It's kind of hard to overstate how unhinged this whole frenzy was. And and this is actually where the reputation of anarchists in the U.S. comes from, basically. The not picnics, not mutual aid societies, not supporting one another in labor struggle, just bombs, 100% bombs. That's all an anarchist is a walking bomb, which I guess is kind of like today and like smashing windows.
In total fairness, some of the anarchists were not doing anything to dissuade that attitude.
It's true.
Like, well, I am literally a walking bomb. I always have dynamite on me in case I need to blow myself
true.
Up.
It's true. And okay, so to quote Paul Avrich, the historian, about how the New York Times and other newspapers handled all of this. The New York Times offered the following prescription. In the early stages of an acute outbreak of anarchy, a Gatling gun, or if the case be severe too, is the sovereign remedy. Later on, hemp in judicious doses has an admirable effect in preventing the spread of the disease. The Philadelphia Inquirer recommended a mailed hand to each of the anarchists that America was not shelter for cutthroats and thieves, while the Louisville Courier Journal insisted that the blatant cattle should be strung up, the sooner the better. Judge Lynch is a tremendous expounder of the law. It is no time for half measures, agreed the Springfield Republican, urging the authorities to make an example of the ringleaders. There are no good anarchists except dead anarchists, the St. Louis Globe Democrat chimed in. Globe is another one of those things that every newspaper had to be called Globe. It was like one of
now,
the five.
When they're
names.
Talking about hemp, they're talking about like hanging people, right? They're not saying you should get them stoned, right? Okay, yes.
Yeah, no, right. Yeah. I mean, that would probably work if I was nervous about a bunch of anarchists who were threatening me. I might just buy them all weed.
Yeah.
I feel like they wouldn't
threaten
me anymore.
Not a bad way to get anarchists on your side.
Yeah. In Chicago, the cops raided everywhere. They raided like 50 gathering places. They raided people's homes. They never had any kind of warrants. They didn't bother. The prosecutor who later tried the case gave the cops permission by saying, make the raids first and look up the laws later. In one house, they confiscated a kid's pillowcases because they were red.
Okay.
Yeah. Hundreds of people were arrested and tortured. Many of them were offered bribes for information, but almost everyone refused to cooperate. Some people did
cooperate. I was going to say, living in their heads rent-free until you talked about all the folks that they tortured.
Yeah. For 2 months, all constitutional rights for everyone in Chicago were dropped illegally. Like, mail was opened, papers were shut down, union gatherings were dispersed, public gatherings were banned. It just, there was no rule of law in Chicago.
It does kind of seem like historically an awful lot of people are willing to end the concept of civil rights as soon as someone says there's anarchists about.
Right. Which has some deep irony, right? The anarchists are like, law is bad. And they're like, no, we think law is really bad. And that's why we're going to suspend it to go around and beat you all up and arrest you. And they arrested basically all the editors of all the anarchist papers, except Albert Parsons, who fucked off to Wisconsin. And then Lucy Parsons managed to get arrested 4 times in the ensuing weeks, and you'll be shocked to know that they said racist and sexist shit to her when they arrested her.
Cops?
I know. At one point,
well,
this one's kind of bad.
To take my thin blue line flag down.
Well, they broke into her house, tied up her 6-year-old kid on the floor, and then started spinning him around while screaming, basically, "Where's your dad? We're going to hang him."
Oh my God. Christ. Jesus fucking Christ. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. In the end, a grand jury indicted 10 of them to stand trial, 10 of the anarchists. One of them went state's evidence. Most of the rest were editors and printers at three of the newspapers, which was the English language, The Alarm, the German language, Arbeiterzeitung, which means worker paper, because again, really, really literal naming schemes.
Yeah, again, and your pronunciation was perfect as an expert on the German language. I feel confident stating that.
And then the third paper, Der Anarchist, which means the anarchist. You probably figured that part out. Of the remaining people who got indicted, one of them was a young firebrand, and one of them was a guy who just took off. He just was like, I'm gone. They arrested him for like, his name was Rudolf Schnaub. And a lot of people say he's the one who threw the bomb. I actually don't believe this. And I'll get it more into that later. He was arrested in the aftermath of all of this. And then but he spent like 10 hours in the sweat box, they ended up calling it, the police, where they put everyone in the sweat box, and that's where they tortured them. He refused to talk. He was released. He completely just fucked off. He politely went and told his boss that he wasn't going to come into work for a bit. And then he just disappeared.
What a gentleman.
I know. He left Chicago. He made his way across the border into Canada. And then some indigenous folks and then later international anarchists smuggled him to Europe and then South America, where he lived out the rest of his days in peace. And
well, that's good.
Yeah. And he basically, everyone was like, oh, this is the guy who threw the bomb. And I think actually in some ways it kind of worked out for people to have everyone think it was this guy. But
because he's out. Yeah.
Yeah. But it wasn't him. And he just didn't want to stand trial. And he got to live a long and happy life for having made that decision. So they went to trial. And it was a complete, eight of them did. And it was a complete sham. None of the eight defendants were accused of actually throwing the bomb. It was a murder trial. And none of them were actually, I mean, they were accused of doing it, but they weren't, they didn't say you threw the bomb, but they said you're guilty of murder because you're you, because you're an anarchist. And the judge who oversaw it was completely committed to conviction rather than obeying the law. Witnesses for the prosecution were usually paid by the prosecution. The jury was selected specifically in order to convict them. And we know all of this because later the governor of Illinois wrote a pardon for everyone who was left. And he just, it's a 17,000 word pardon that he wrote, being like,
Jesus Christ,
everything that happened in this trial was wrong and basically a crime.
That's like 3.5 episodes of Behind the Bastards for a pardon.
Yeah. So it's basically one of the most rigged trials in American history, which is saying something. I feel like they really went the extra mile here. And they had to find a lawyer to defend them. And everyone was like, I'm not going to fucking defend these people. I will never work again. But they found this guy who's, I think, really cool. He's one of my cool people. He was not an anarchist. He was a moderate. And his name was Captain William Black. He'd been born a Southerner, and then he betrayed his family as a teenager to volunteer for the Union Army. So already he's kind of
liking this guy already. Yeah.
I know.
Sounds pretty based from the start.
Yeah. And he was just this, he was like a rising star corporate lawyer, but he believed in the law. And they came to him and they were like, look, no one wants to take our case, and you're a really good lawyer. And we're not guilty, and it's so obvious. Mm-hmm. And he did some soul searching. He's like, all right, I'm going to tank my entire career to defend you for barely any money. And he spent 2 years of his life working on their case and tanked his career. It didn't recover for decades afterwards.
Wow. What a fucking hero. Good for him.
I know. I like this guy. And then Albert Parsons turned himself in. I think it was the first day of trial or something. It was very early on. He just is like, okay, I need to show up and stand in solidarity with these people. But also he thought he was going to win because it was so obviously a bullshit case against him. And so I think for some, at the core of his heart, he still actually believed in the American legal system, which was entirely naive. After a few months of trial, and the defense proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that none of the defendants had made or thrown the bomb in question, the jury took 3 hours to return with a guilty verdict. Seven of them were sentenced to hang. One man, Oscar Neeb, was sentenced to 15 years in prison. I think only a tiny handful of people, maybe a few lawyers and the rare politician, actually believe in law. The judge and the prosecutor and the jury clearly didn't. It was just a tool to be used to achieve their goal. The prosecutor, in his final address to the jury, said, They are no more guilty than the thousands who follow them. Gentlemen of the jury, convict these men, make examples of them, hang them, and you save our institutions, our society.
Our institutions are valid because we are happy to violate every tenet of them in order to blame these people to protect our institutions, which are valid.
Yeah, exactly.
God, it really makes you feel for Black as like a guy who believes in institutions, but like, really? I am curious to learn more about what was going on in this dude's soul as this all shook out. It could not have been an emotionally easy thing to handle.
It was really hard for him. The Paul Avrich book talks about him a lot, actually, and talks about how like hard on it was on him and his wife, and like just how society treated him and all of these things, but how he ended up basically like friends with these people, even though he was like, I don't agree with what they want, but I believe that they are like honest and upstanding people who are doing what they believe is right. And
there's a lesson there too for anarchists in the value of speaking to moderates, and sometimes they wind up torpedoing their entire life to defend you, you know? That's also a nice message to take out of this.
Totally. Okay, so before the sentencing, the judge allowed each one to make a speech, and the speeches lasted for days, mostly because Albert Parsons was there.
Right.
But this guy. Yeah. I feel bad making fun of this dude who's like, he's going to die. He's going to die
the
doing
last
something
guy up again.
I believe
Jesus.
Yeah.
No, I mean, look, no speech at a protest should last more than 5 minutes. But I think days is the right amount of time for this sort of speech to last.
Yes.
Like, yes. Make him sit with it, you know?
And if you want to read these speeches, then they are the Haymarket Martyrs are the advertisers who support this show, because they are still alive and with us. And here are the ads that they are providing to us for you to hear.
Are you walking down the street with 3 to 4 pounds of dynamite on your body? Why not? Order 1-800-DYNAMITE today to buy enough dynamite to protect yourself from anything except for dynamite, which you'll be much more vulnerable to.
Exactly. Here's the rest of the ads.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Artesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Okay, we're back. And if you want to hear the rest of the speeches, besides the ones that advertise on this show, I recommend that you go. If there's one thing that you follow up and read about Haymarket, the speeches are really beautiful pieces. And now I get to introduce to you all the defendants, and it's kind of fun. They're kind of interesting people. They're mostly German. Fortunately, I can pronounce most of their names. So August Spies went first. We met him some already, and he was the editor of the Arbeiter Zeitung. He was the oldest of five kids. He was born in central Germany. He was a Sagittarius. He was a happy childhood. He was raised to be a forester for the government like his dad until his dad died. And then he left school and emigrated to the US. And then he became an upholsterer. He opened his own shop. He saw someone give a lecture on socialism and he was like, oh, that actually makes some sense. And then the 1877 strike happened and he was like, oh, that really makes some sense. And soon enough, he found himself an anarchist and he joined the Lehr und Wehrverein. And kind of ironically, for the fight for the 8-hour workday, he worked like 12 to 16 hour days at his German paper. And
wow. I mean, that's the thing with anarchists. It's like, no, we don't want to work an 8-hour workday. But if I'm doing the thing I want to do, then I will work for like 19 hours a day, of course.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
The thing I want to be doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's this guy. And he actually keeps a circle bomb on his desk in his office. And we don't know whether or not the circle bomb was actually like, you know, one of those old timey bombs. It's a circle and has a little fuse coming out of it. That was probably the type of bomb that was thrown at the cops. We don't know whether or not the bomb in his office had any dynamite in it or not. And the historical record would really like you to know that August Spies was fucking hot.
That's good. You know, I was going to ask because I'm incapable of actually caring about people if they were not hot.
Right. Well, you're in luck, actually.
That's why I have created a new hot or not that is specifically for the victims of war crimes. So you can tell if you need to feel bad about a specific war crime by knowing if they were hot or not.
That's excellent. I look forward to using this service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sponsored by Microsoft.
So August Spies was known as a ladies' man. He was one of the only people who wasn't already married at the start of all this thing. And he was...
Yeah.
But he was also... He was sardonic and haughty, but he also refused to lie. And he basically just like walked around and he threw around his charisma and charmed women and men. And
yeah, he did.
And he once spoke in front of Congress about socialism. And he just like went and he was like, yeah, we're going to have a revolution. And he was like...
You got this guy's number?
he was like... We're not going to make the revolution. We're anticipating the revolution. We are, his quote was, birds of the coming storm. And it was...
Ooh, that's the hottest thing yet. That's good.
I know. And
that's
then
good.
Someone in Congress is like, well, why do you hate the individual with your socialism or whatever? And he's like, are you kidding me? It's the capitalists who treat workers like they're just cogs in a machine. Mm. And to quote from his final address to the court, not to Congress, but when he's sentenced to death, if you think that by hanging us, you can stamp out the labor movement, the movement from which the downtrodden millions, the millions who toil and live in want and misery, the wage slaves, expect salvation, if that is your opinion, then hang us. Here you will tread upon a spark, but here and there and behind us and in front of you and everywhere, the flames will blaze up. It is a subterranean fire. You cannot put it out.
Holy shit, that's...
I know.
That's hot girl shit.
Yeah.
That's some hot girl shit.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Did he do his own like writing? Is this all him or does he have like, you know,
yeah, he's
a team?
That's kind of his
something?
Thing, is he's one of the the editors of these papers, they're also like publishing their own shit a ton.
Sure.
Right? These people have been giving speeches and like writing propaganda. That's like their thing, you know, which is why I think that they're both leaders of the movement and not, is because they were actually more the propagandists who got put on trial in this trial rather than like necessarily the people who are organizing and like planning actions and stuff. Okay, so Michael Schwab goes and gives his speech next. And this guy's not as much of a talker. He's just a quiet, thoughtful man behind a big dark beard. He's married. He's a father of two. He's like just a hard worker for the revolution. He's a reporter and editor for the Arbiter Zeitung, and he ran the IWPA's library. He was just basically seen as very gentle. He was 32 at the time of the bombing. He was born in Germany with a peasant mother and a tradesman father. And he had a happy childhood until, and this feels like a pattern, maybe it's just the 19th century, his mom died when he was 8 and his dad died when he was 12.
Well,
yeah,
hey, they made, you know what? They made it a decent chunk of time.
Yeah, it's true.
Little kid, you're going to have to carry yourself across that finish line.
Yeah. And so when he's like, I don't know, 13 or something, he apprentices to a bookbinder and he starts working 13 to 17 hour days.
Yeah.
And then he joins a bookbinding union and then the Social Democrat Party. And then and he decides that political liberty without economic freedom is a mocking lie, is like his big thing. He moves to Chicago. He quickly learns that American capitalism is no better than European, which actually happens to a lot of people. A lot of the immigrants are like, oh, land of opportunity. And they're like, what? What? No, this is just as bad. I feel betrayed. And shortly enough, he becomes an anarchist. In his speech at sentencing, he said, violence is one thing and anarchy another. In the present state of society, violence is used on all sides, and therefore we advocate the use of violence against violence, but against violence only as a matter, as a necessary means of defense. Then you get Oscar Niebe. He was another worker at the Arbiter Zeitung. It really wasn't a good time to be in the newspaper business. Mm-hmm. And he was the only one who wasn't sentenced to death. He'd been born in the U.S. to German immigrants, and he worked basically every kind of job from cook to tinsmith. So then he was unemployed for a while. And at the time of his arrest, he was a yeast peddler. I don't even know what kind of yeast, but he would go around with a cart in the street, just like, get your yeast.
Yeast for sale. Yeast for sale.
Yeah.
Like, mix it with your dynamite.
Robert.
The main thing that he wanted people to know in his very short speech was that he wanted to be hanged too.
Oh,
his quote
buddy.
Is, for I think it is more honorable to die suddenly than to be killed by inches. I have a family and children. If they know their father is dead, they will bury him. They can go to the grave and kneel down by the side of it, but they can't go to the penitentiary and see their father who is convicted for a crime that he has had nothing to do with.
Oh,
well,
that's
yeah,
sad as shit.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Hard to argue with the logic, though.
And then his wife died while he was in prison and he wasn't allowed to go to her funeral.
Jeez. Oh,
and then we get Adolf Fischer. It's not a common name
really
anymore.
Really close to being a bad name.
Yeah. He edited Der Anarchist, which was the more radical paper than Arbiter Zeitung. And he advocated less for a mass movement and more for autonomous actions by individuals and collectives. He was born in Germany. He was a second generation socialist. He moved to America, worked as a typographer. And then as soon as he moved to Chicago, he joined the Lehr und Verein, the militia. And when he was arrested, he was armed. He had presumably legally both a revolver and a dagger. And then one cop took his revolver out, pointed at his head. Another cop put the dagger to his chest, and they only didn't kill him when the lieutenant intervened because they wanted him to stand trial instead. And in prison, two of his co-defendants who didn't speak English entrusted him to translate their autobiographies. And basically he was this like, he just worked constantly and to give money to the cause. And he was really looking forward to the revolution. And he gave the shortest speech of them all, which included, I was tried here in this room for murder and I was convicted of anarchy. I protest against being sentenced to death because I have not been found guilty of murder. However, if I am to die on account of being an anarchist, on account of my love for liberty, fraternity, and equality, I will not remonstrate. If death is the penalty for our love of freedom of the human race, then I say openly, I have forfeited my life, but a murderer, I am not. I just really like all these speeches.
Yeah.
Okay.
These are all really, really good lines.
All right. Then we get to Louis Ling. Louis Ling is a crowd pleaser. He was the youngest. He was 21 when the bomb was thrown and he had a watertight alibi. There's no way he could have thrown the bomb. Do you know why he couldn't have thrown the bomb?
Was he making more bombs?
Yeah, he was. He was. He was too busy at home making bombs.
Incredible.
I know. And when the cops came to arrest him, he tried to go down fighting and he almost killed one officer with his bare hands before the other one like knocked him down.
Unbelievable. What a Chad.
And then the New York Times, which was completely untrustworthy of a source at the time, especially back then, says that while he was on the carriage on the way to jail, he basically said, "It all would have been worth it if only I'd been able to kill that police officer." Which, frankly, he might have said.
Yeah, I look, based on the man you've described, I don't think the police maybe lied about that one.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds in line with our boy.
Yeah. Okay, so he had just shown up in the U.S. 10 months earlier before all this shit happens. He had been born in Germany, and then he had a happy childhood until, you'll be shocked to know. Well, first his dad was thrown out of work for a workplace accident, and then he died shortly thereafter. And he and his sibling and his mother fought starvation every single day. He fled Europe to avoid the draft, and then he joined the Carpenters Union, soon found work as an organizer. People liked him. He was really scrupulously honest and upfront, which was basically universal among all the Chicago anarchists, which I think mm-hmm. fucking rules, because it, mm-hmm. if you're going to be all about something, just be honest. I mean, sometimes you got to lie to avoid certain situations.
Hey,
but
it's like what was it? Was it Bob Dylan that said that? To live outside the law, a man must be honest. I forget where that came from, but
yeah. Yeah, that's what these people are doing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know you're wondering where Louis Ling lays in the relative hotness of the various defendants.
Literally am incapable of caring about this story emotionally until I learned.
Okay, well, if you want to, you should Google Louis Ling. It's two G's okay. in Ling. And don't use the photo from Wikipedia as the example. Find one where his hair is shorter and he doesn't really have a beard.
He kind of looks like Elijah Wood.
Yeah, that's true.
He's got a little bit of an, like, kind of a broader chin, but like a little bit of that Elijah Wood vibe up in his T-zone. Yeah. You could like cast Elijah Wood to play this guy and it would work pretty well.
I would love to watch that. Okay, and then in case you're wondering, I wonder whether any of the Haymarket folks were queer, I want to read you this description of Louis Ling written by William Holmes, another anarchist in their circle. "Ling was one of the handsomest men this writer has ever met. His well-shaped head crowned with a wealth of curly chestnut hair, his fine blue eyes, his peach and white complexion and straight, regular features made him a fit model for a Greek god, while his athletic form and general activity showed him to be possessed of an abundance of physical vigor and health."
Well, that just sounds straight as hell to me, Margaret.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And fortunately, we're kind of...
That just sounds super straight.
Yeah. You're describing the straightest situation in the world. And to be fair, like, heterosexuality and homosexuality, like, didn't exist as concepts at this point.
No.
And so...
Homosexuality, the word, was invented by a German dude in, like, the 1890s?
Yeah, sounds about right. But I've got my headcanon, and that's what matters here. But he was a sex symbol in the anarchist scene. Like, younger men adopted his haircut and his, quote, lithe way of walking around the ballroom at all the anarchist balls. To get called his name was like the highest compliment you could give someone. And his speech was the fieriest of the bunch. He delivered it in German. And he ended it with, I'm not going to do the whole thing in German. I'm not going to do any of it in German. He ended it with... "I repeat that I am the enemy of the order of today, and I repeat that with all my powers, as long as breath remains in me, I shall combat it. I declare again, frankly and openly, that I am in favor of using force. I have told Captain Shack, and I stand by it, if you cannonade us, we will dynamite you. You laugh, you think, you'll throw no more bombs, but let me assure you that I die happy on the gallows, so confident am I in that the hundreds and thousands to whom I have spoken will remember my words, and when you shall have hanged us, then, mark my words, they will do the bomb throwing. In this hope I say to you, I despise you. I despise your order, your laws, your force-propped authority. Hang me for it." He wasn't actually right about the everyone else doing the bomb throwing part. It's kind of... for better or worse, I'm not actually sure one way or the other. But now we get George Engel, who I have a tattoo of on my arm. I'm going to show you the tattoo, even though no one else can see it.
So you're saying you really, really don't like this person?
Yeah, this is definitely my least favorite person. This stick figure drawn on my arm.
It's like the tattoo I have of Roger Stone.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Jesus.
Well, that's cute.
Okay, so George Engel is the oldest of them all, much like Robert Roger Stone. And he's about 50 years old, and he owns a toy shop with his wife. And he works for the anarchist. And he was born in Germany. You'll be shocked to know this. He was orphaned young.
Oh, whoa.
And he was taken in by a painter who apprenticed him. He came to the U.S. He found the U.S. just as bad as Germany. He first joined the socialists, but he grew disillusioned by all their politicking, the maneuvering, the opportunism, the rigged election, the compromise of principle. So he joined the anarchists. And he wasn't a speaker or a writer. He was just this guy who supported the movement with absolute sincerity. But he was also one of the most radical in his beliefs of the whole bunch. Like, he'd probably, the night before the Haymarket rally, he'd probably been meeting in a bar with some other of the more radical people, like not Parsons and Spies and all those, to figure out how, with the like 2,000 armed men they had, that if they needed to, they could take the city, like which places they would raid to get more guns and shit.
Yeah.
And which, you know, you've just watched everyone get shot in the middle of the big uprising. He also hated Schwab and Spies because they weren't radical enough and he hadn't been on speaking terms with Spies. And I kind of love hate the idea that you have to like go face the death penalty with people you have like really serious scene drama with.
I mean, I would hope he would be like at that point, like, well, okay, maybe we had disagreements before, but clearly we're all committed to the same degree now that we're about to get executed. Like, I can't really hit them for not being committed enough as we're all about to die together. You would hope, right?
I think so. I think he like didn't like, he doesn't like super trust them, but he's like, yeah, okay. Like, this
well,
is.
Yeah, we're all about to die together, so.
Yeah.
Probably shouldn't kvetch too much.
Yeah. When they arrested him, they just literally showed up at his house and disappeared him. And his family didn't know what happened to him for days until his daughter went to the jail and then heard him like singing distantly down the cell block. And in his final address to court, he said, "We see from the history of this country that the first colonists won their liberty only through force, that through force slavery was abolished. And just as the man who agitated against slavery in this country had to ascend the gallows, so also must we. He who speaks for the working man today must hang." And then Samuel Fielden. This is the guy who couldn't get a break, got shot in the knee, spoke last at the rally. He wasn't German, which is a big break from everyone else. He was born
up. Did his parents survive to see him hit the ripe old age of 11?
I think so, actually.
Yay!
He's kind of he comes out this whole thing the winner. As much as you can win this particular, this is like a, what's this? It's like a Squid Games thing. Mm-hmm. He wins. He's born a poor weaver in England. Like, he starts working at the age of 8. So I feel like you can say you were born a weaver at that point. And he works in the cotton mills that Karl Marx and George Engels based their whole analysis of how shitty the English working class have it, like on the cotton mills in his town. And he cuts his political teeth in England, speaking on behalf of the Union in the States and against slavery. Then he moves to the U.S. and he takes whatever work he can. And he's like a Methodist traveling preacher. And he travels the South and becomes dismayed by the conditions of black folks there. He's white. He settled in Chicago and then he started working 12 to 14 hour days as a stone cutter. And then he found himself as a speaker for the anarchists, again, the kind of like the C-list one. And he's the treasurer for the IWPA. And when he speaks in the courtroom, apparently it actually, he kind of pulls it off. It actually... A-list speaker today. That brings the entire courtroom to tears. And the prosecutor laughs and says, "It's a good thing the jury hadn't been here to hear this speech before they made their verdict."
Jesus. What a goblin.
Yeah, he really is. In his speech, Fielden says, "We feel satisfied that we have not lived in this world for nothing, that we have done some good for our fellow man, and done what we believe to be in the interest of humanity and for the furtherance of justice. If my life is to be taken for advocating the principles of socialism and anarchy, as I have understood them and honestly believe them in the interest of humanity, I say to you that I gladly give it up, and the price is very small for the result that is gained." I will now read the entire speech of Albert Parsons. No, I'm just kidding. Albert Parsons goes up. He's last. He speaks for 8 hours over 2 days.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. He kind of just loses his way and rambles a lot.
Is he vamping a bit? Yeah.
Yeah. And I get the impression that this whole ordeal actually breaks him harder than it breaks the other folks. Or he breaks in a different way, maybe.
Yeah.
And he has very few like baller lines that are worth repeating. But near the end, he said, "I have nothing, not even now, to regret." Well, speaking of regrets, here are the ads that support this show.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Okay, so the appeals go on for over a year. They reach all the way to the Supreme Court, who decides against the anarchists. And Lucy Parsons and a bunch of the other people from the IWPA spend the whole time traveling the country, giving talks about the trial and the defendants. And this is happening in the middle of all this hysteria, right? Lucy's arrested like multiple times over the course of this. And her events are shut down everywhere she goes, but it's still largely successful. The moment of panic recedes, and then popular opinion starts to shift back towards the defendants, and the rest of the labor movement manages to find its spine again. At the beginning, the labor movement's like, whoa, we don't know these guys, even though like they were all involved in all levels of the labor movement. And then eventually the labor movement's like, okay, maybe we know these guys. And it led to this peak in people paying attention to what was going on and people becoming anarchists. The Arbiter Zeitung, that newspaper, goes from 4,000 subscribers to 10,000. As more and more people see the hypocrisy of the government and adopt socialist and anarchist views. And there's rallies across the country and the world. And then kind of, again, ironically or fittingly, some of their most ardent supporters at this time end up being people who hate their politics, but hate even more so to see the US legal system be like just made a mockery of by this trial. And now the prisoners are all celebrities. They're doomed celebrities. But I want to tell you about what August Spies gets up to while he's a celebrity, because he couldn't be fucked to get married before, but he finally marries once he's in jail.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. And he marries a woman he had never met who just started coming to the trial.
Awesome.
And she's
awesome.
An heiress. Nina Van Zandt is an heiress to a fortune and is a member of high society. And this is like crazy scandalous through all the papers. And apparently some of the other defendants are like, don't do this. This might affect the case or whatever. And he's like, no, I'm marrying this lady. But he wasn't allowed to attend his own wedding. So his brother, the one who got shot in the groin defending him, is a stand-in as a proxy for the wedding. And they basically got married so that she could keep visiting him in jail. And I actually think these were not conjugal visits. I think that they like never got to do more than like once kiss through the bars in a very dramatic and romantic way.
Yeah.
I know. And she's kind of interesting. She gives up like a $400,000 inheritance, which because her family's pissed off about this, which is $12 million today.
Jesus.
And she.
Wow. So it's definitely not like poverty tourism. She actually like makes a massive sacrifice.
She moves to poverty. She's like, I like this town.
Yeah.
And she keeps her name.
Opposite of the Chick and the Common People song.
Yeah, exactly. I love that song. It's a really good bitter song to listen
great
to.
Great song. Yeah, yeah.
So because Nina Spies keeps her name even after her husband dies. And she even like gets remarried and then divorced and then goes back to the name Spies because she's now a committed, I presume, anarchist. And she lives in poverty. She ends up an old lady who collects stray cats and dogs, and she marches in labor demonstrations. And she's still alive today. No, but that would rule. Like, if you got to, like...
That would be amazing.
So the Supreme Court says, no, fuck these guys. So then they move to a strategy of trying to get the governor to give them clemency and commute their sentences to life in prison. And they get thousands of letters from support from all walks of life, radicals and moderates. And there's still probably more Americans who hate them, but it's like... Well, this is something that's totally unfamiliar to modern society. Society was very polarized by this. And a lot of the moderates instead ended up taking radical positions on one side or another. The son of John Brown writes them a letter and sends them a fruit basket. And he says, basically, I support you and my father would have supported you. And that had he had the chance, John Brown would have been a socialist too, since what he believed in was the, quote, community plan of cooperative industry.
Aw.
The fruit basket is a nice touch.
The fruit basket is a nice touch.
I hope that they were
there's always that debate about like, would John Brown have been like problematic today? Because he was, you know, he was also a religious extremist.
Yeah, totally.
Which is the thing that can go a couple of ways. But no, I think his kid's probably right. I think being on the right side of slavery to that extent at that time means he probably would have been on the right side of a lot of things.
Yeah. And you know, who would know better than the kid who's named John Brown Jr., you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, only three of the... But, okay, so they do all of this work to get clemency, and only three of them end up actually writing the governor for clemency, because there's a big problem. To write the governor for clemency, you have to say you're sorry.
No.
They are not sorry. So Fielden and Schwab are like, sure, whatever. We're sorry.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Could you not kill us? Mm-hmm. And then Spies says, I'm sorry too. But then Spies freaks out and has this moment of like, everyone calls him a sellout. And he's like, no, I take it back. And he writes the governor a second letter. And he's like, no, I'm just kidding. Not only am I not sorry, but you should kill only me and leave everyone else go.
Wow. That's a man who values the clout.
Yeah, I know. Original clout chaser, August Spies.
Yeah. It's fun.
Okay, and then
I mean it's not fun, but yeah, like I mean, honestly, anything you do in that situation is fine.
I agree.
I would never judge anybody for being like, well, I will say I'm sorry to not get murdered.
Yeah.
That's fine. At the same time, I also respect heavily anyone who would be like, fuck that shit. I ain't sorry.
Yeah.
Like you can hang my ass.
Parsons ended up actually the most torn because he's the one who's like really like, you know, he's kind of broken at this point, but he's a true believer, right? And he's basically like asking all his friends for advice. He's like, what do I do? What do I do? And then one of his friends, this guy named Dyer Lum, is like, honey, Albert, what you should do is die. And Albert's like, thank you.
God.
You're the only one willing to tell me that. Thank you.
That is so intense.
Jesus.
I know. Whoa. So he decides to die. And so he writes an open letter to the governor, and his open letter says, look, if I'm innocent, let me go. And if I'm guilty, kill me. So the governor grants clemency at like the final hour to Fielden and Schwab and the five who refuse to say they're sorry, were to die. And now I'm going to tell you who threw the fucking bomb. Eh?
Oh, good.
Okay. Because the anonymous bomber comes back into play at this point. We don't know for sure, right? But historian Paul Avrich has done more work than anyone who I actually trust about this. And Albert Parsons was convinced a cop did it. It was like a Pinkerton did it. He's like, oh, it's a false flag attack, right?
False flag type deal.
But basically, probably while all this is happening, the bomber was probably this guy named George Schwab, who's completely unrelated to Michael Schwab. And he fucks off to New York after the bomb is thrown. And then when they're sentenced to die and everything, like the Supreme Court thing fails and all this shit, he's like, hey, should I come forward? Will that save these people's lives? If I say I'm the one who did it, will they be let go? And they all kind of think about it. And when I say they all, not everyone, like the defendants don't know this, except the two autonomous ones who are more, not actually Louis Ling, but the two autonomous ones who ran Dare Anarchist. They end up knowing about it. And they finally sit down and they're like, no, if you come forward, you're just going to die too. It's just one more victim of capitalism if you come forward.
Yeah.
So the bomber is like, all right. And he does not come forward.
Oof, that's a lot to live with.
Yeah. And then Louis Ling, not only did he not write for clemency, he actually had his name taken off the Supreme Court case because he was, I'm done with capitalist justice. I have nothing to do with any of this.
Wow.
So a week before the execution, guards find bombs in his cell. He has four bombs. And I always thought that they were there to like affect a prison break. But apparently the fuses were like a second or two long. So they were almost certainly there so he could kill himself. But they find the bombs. So he doesn't get to kill himself in a nice, clean, explodey way. And instead, the day before the execution, Louis Ling has somehow got a hold of a blasting cap. There's a lot of different claims about how he got it there. He puts it in his mouth and he blows himself up, takes his own life.
Wow.
But because it's only a blasting cap, it takes 6 hours for him to bleed to death.
Oh, Jesus. Oh.
And since this is his exit from history, I'll say that a few days before he died, his mother and aunt had written him letters. And his mother wrote, I will be as proud of you after your death as I have been during your life. And his aunt wrote, whatever happens, even the worst, show no weakness before those wretches. So he had a supportive family.
That's good. The one person whose family wasn't dead.
I know, exactly. And then the night before the execution, all the condemned men, they're sitting around, they're smoking cigars and they're talking with jailers. It's apparently somehow very friendly. Parsons keeps like singing and reciting poetry every chance he gets. I'm pretty sure Parsons has lost his mind, which I do not blame him at all. I am certain I would entirely lose my mind in this environment.
I've lost my mind on like 5 hour long flights before.
Yeah, yeah. George Engel, my favorite. He talks with the priest who comes to offer him his last rites. And I'm going to say, quote what he said to the priest. In the shadow of the gallows, as I stand, I have done nothing wrong. I have not done everything right during my life, but I have endeavored to live so that I need not fear to die. Monopoly has crushed competition, and the poor man has no show, but the revolution will surely come, and the working man will get his rights. Socialism and Christianity can walk hand in hand together as brothers, for both are laboring in the interests of the amelioration of mankind. I have no religion but to wrong no man and to do good to everybody. And it's a cool guy.
Yeah.
He's being nice to the priest that he didn't even call for. He like, as the priest is leaving, he's like, look, hey, I know that was weird, but I didn't even call for you, okay? The execution. On the morning of the execution, there's 300 cops and they're guarding the prison like it's a fortress. And there's, once again, Gatling guns laying in wait. And for once, the media is right. The media is on about how an army of anarchists is going to descend on the place and free them all. But actually, the anarchists had come up with a plan like that. And actually, it was the condemned men who were like, guys, it's over. It's fine. Let us just get this over with. So that's why there's no massive last-minute jailbreak. Lucy Parsons shows up to see her husband. She has her two kids in tow. And an officer tries to stop her. She says, you're going to have to fucking kill me. And then she just like pushes her way through the police line. However, they then arrest her, strip her naked, leave her in a cell with her kids until after her husband was hanged.
Jesus.
With a noose around their neck, each man shouts their last words. Spies says, there will come a time when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today. Engel shouts in German, Hoch die Anarchie, or Hurrah for Anarchy. Fischer shouts, also in German, Hurrah for Anarchy, this is the happiest day of my life. And then Parsons, he says, I feel bad making fun of him right now, but I'm just going to do it. I'll just quote him, and he'll make fun of himself. I'm sorry, Parsons, you were a great guy. Parsons says, Will I be allowed to speak, O men of America? Let me speak, Sheriff Mattson. Let the voice of the people be heard. Oh. And then the trap opens. And the hanging was done wrong, and they took long, like, they took minutes to strangle. I think it took 7 minutes for the last one to die.
Sure, that was an accident.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, classic. Whoops, I've been doing this my whole life, and I just somehow slipped up and didn't break their necks. Their funeral march had 20,000 participants and 200,000 onlookers. And again, I actually should have looked up the population of Chicago at the time, but 220,000 people in 1887. It's a lot of people.
A lot.
Yeah. It's the largest funeral that had ever been seen in Chicago. And basically, unions and radicals across the world commemorate their deaths and still do on May 1st, and which is the workers' holiday, like I said at the top, in every country of the world except the U.S., where they can't handle the radical stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
But to close out the rest of our characters, you want to know what happened to Captain Blackjack Bonfield, right? The cop who charged the crowd. Well,
yes.
He was caught taking bribes. And among the stolen goods he was storing was the personal effects of Louis Ling. Everyone had been like, hey, where's Louis Ling's stuff? And the cop's like, oh, I don't know. And it's because this dude had stolen it. He gets fired, which is actually, that might be a sign of the times having changed in a bad way. He actually gets fired for this. And and that's actually the impetus to start getting the pardon pushed forward. Is they're like, look, the main guy for the prosecution was a piece of shit corrupt cop. And they get pardoned. A progressive is elected governor of Illinois in 1893. And he, once again, he tanks his entire career. It costs him the re-election, but he pardons the remaining. He frees the remaining three who are still in prison, and he posthumously pardons the five who died. And he never managed to get back into office after doing that. But
well,
he actually cared about justice.
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah.
Another moderate who made a sacrifice
for
these people. That is nice to see a couple of times, in addition to all of the ones who stood by and did nothing. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay, then there's the fun of the cop statue. In 1889, the police put up a statue in Haymarket Square in honor of the fallen officer, the only one who had actually...
Oh, the one who didn't get killed by other cops?
Yeah, exactly. For some reason, they didn't do one of all the people who had been murdered by officers in that. It wasn't a picture of dual-wielding Blackjack shooting down other cops.
A monument to the cops killed by other cops.
It's called Critical Support, the monument.
Yeah.
All right. So the model for this cop, they don't use the actual dead cop as the model. They take a living cop, a guy named Birmingham, and he's crooked as shit.
Was the dead cop ugly? Were they just like, that guy's not sexy enough for a statue?
Yeah, I got to assume. So they pick a crooked cop who then gets fired for fencing stolen goods.
Incredible. Yeah. What an amazing monument.
And then in 1903, someone steals the crest of the city off the statue. In 1925, a streetcar driver, probably on purpose, jumps the tracks with the streetcar and plows down the statue. It gets moved to a place called Union Park. On May 4th, 1968, it was defaced with black paint. The next year, the Weathermen, who are the part of a radical faction in the anti-war movement, they just fucking blow up the statue.
Ugh. Nice to hear they got one of those bombs right.
Well, they get two of them right because then...
Yeah, they got a couple right.
Well, they get at least two of them right because they rebuild the statue, and then a year later, the Weathermen blow it up again.
Excellent.
And then it was rebuilt once more, and now it's in the lobby of the Chicago Police Headquarters, where every day, every cop can see a statue of a crooked cop.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't win... Not the cop statue, but Haymarket. It didn't win them the 8-hour workday, but... As far as I can tell, it didn't actually delay it as much as sometimes people say. The labor movement in the U.S. and especially worldwide actually grew eventually with this. And basically, one by one, various trades and unions won better hours. By 1937, the Fair Labor Standards Act finally won it for more or less everyone nationwide.
That's good.
Anarchism in Chicago kind of faded after the trial, but anarchism worldwide grew. And basically, everywhere you would go across the world in any kind of labor hall, you would see the Haymarket Martyrs. You'd see pictures of them. it leaves me with this like really complicated takeaway, right? Because their rhetoric of violence is kind of what got them into this mess on some level.
Yes. And certainly all of the dynamite had an impact on all of the dynamite.
Right. But it's really hard to say whether the end result was positive or negative for the labor movement, for anarchism, for any of these things. It's like, it's almost impossible to parse out. And then, and one of the things that I'm left thinking about with this is that like a lot of the stories of Haymarket that you'll read in sort of more mainstream papers will be like, oh, there was this good protest movement and some anarchists came and fucked it all up by throwing a bomb. And that leaves out the fact that it was the anarchists who organized not the whole thing, but a huge chunk of it in the first place. And certainly the thing that got fucked up by someone throwing a bomb. And I feel like that happens a lot, is that people, like radical people, end up organizing this and then that work is forgotten about. And then my final note is that Lucy Parsons, who I opened the story up with, she stayed involved her entire life. And she ended up helping form the union, the Industrial Workers of the World, in 1905, who will probably one day get their own episode. And she used the lessons of Haymarket to teach young radicals. In the 1920s, the Chicago Police Department declared that she was, quote, more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. And that feels like something to aspire to.
Yeah. Yep.
So, Robert, how are you feeling about Haymarket?
I mean, bad. It doesn't, I mean, on the whole, bad time. Mm-hmm. I feel good that a lot of people came around to the fact that it was bullshit. It went in terms of talking about like the long-term value of something like this. It's not bad that the kind of inherent contradictions and facileness of the system and how it exists primarily not to achieve justice, but to do violence against people who threaten power. Like that's not bad. Like it's useful that was done. I don't know how much comfort that was for the families of the deceased, but it seems like it was some comfort for most of the deceased. And May Day is a good holiday.
It is a good holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Dare I say, cool people who did cool stuff? Mm-hmm.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. You know, I went to my favorite May Day that I've been to was in Berlin. And in Berlin, one of the things they do on May Days is all of the bars kind of like move out into the streets. Like they'll just set up like kiosks and stuff with their beer. And for one night, it's allowed to just like throw your bottles everywhere. So there's just like snowdrifts of shattered glass all over the streets. And it's fine, apparently. This one night, you can break glass all you want, all over the damn place. And I had this very fun moment of just like shattering God knows how many beer bottles over the street. And then at one of the S-Bahn stations, my friend like stopped to piss in like a corner. And we get immediately ticketed by the German police.
That's just taking it too far.
Mm-hmm. There's kids hucking bottles at the street signs. Yeah. They're just like, all right, but this isn't okay.
Yeah. We have laws here.
We have rules here.
Yeah.
We have one less rule tonight, but we have rules here. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Margaret. This has been a hoot.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
And dare I say a holler?
Yeah.
No, that's too much.
Okay.
But a hoot.
Do you have anything you want to plug, Robert Evans?
Never.
Never heard of you, Robert Evans? You have anything you want to plug?
I've certainly never heard of me.
Do you host any podcasts?
I do. The Dynamite Cast, where we talk about the health benefits of a dynamite-enriched diet, which are none. Well, actually, it would probably help with certain heart conditions, right? Because nitroglycerin is literally used in one form as a heart medication. So I guess there are some ways that ingesting dynamite might potentially help you, but I doubt it would work if you just were to take the form used as an explosive as a heart medication. But I don't actually know.
Well, you're using it wrong.
I don't know.
Like, okay, have you ever had a headache?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Okay. Now, if you don't want to have a headache, you could explode your entire body.
Well, now that's you see, this is you're really getting onto the subject of my new self-help book, The Explosion Driven Life.
So from what I got from what Robert just said, he was saying, listen to It Could Happen Here, and buy his book After the Revolution.
And check out my new book, The 4 Dynamite Work Week and The 4 Dynamite Body. Both go great together and will teach you how to change your life with just 4 sticks of dynamite.
Amazing. Margaret, where can people follow you?
People can follow me on the internet, on Twitter at Magpie Killjoy, and on Instagram at Margaret Killjoy.
Woohoo!
Doodly doodly doo.
We'll be back next week on Monday with another...
Allegedly
with another cool person who may have done, in fact, something cool. Right, again, Margaret? Allegedly.
With lots of caveats, as always. Yep. Cool people coming up.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back. Plus, no payments for 90 days. And take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.